Nicolas Sarkozy, Mr. Abbas said he would make no quick decision over whether to abandon the talks.
We, the Palestinians, will return to our leaders first so we can decide. We will not give any quick reactions now. We need to study all the results and consequences, a real in-depth study with Palestinian leaders, but also with Arab countries.
Palestinian officials say they'll meet on Wednesday to decide a response, which will then be discussed at an Arab League meeting next week. The opposition in Venezuela has made significant gains in parliamentary elections, overturning the two-thirds majority that President Hugo Chavez's Socialist Party needs to pass major legislation without its support. With almost all the results now in, the governing socialists still hold most seats in the National Assembly. But the opposition, which boycotted the last election in 2005, says it won just over half the popular vote. Sunday's poll was seen as a key test of support for President Chavez ahead of the presidential election due in 2 years' time. The Chinese authorities are investigating allegations that a private security company colluded with local officials to lock up protesters in secret prisons known as black jails. Human rights groups say China has hundreds of such jails. Chinese officials usually deny they exist. Abby Maudsley reports.
The Chinese media say police in Beijing have arrested the chairman and general manager of Anyuanding Security Services on suspicion of illegally detaining people. They're accused of taking money from local governments to abduct and imprison petitioners, people who travel to the capital to file complaints about local abuses. Chinese newspapers say the company tricked petitioners into going to abandoned hotels and houses in the Beijing suburbs, then held them against their will, or forced them to return to their hometowns. The company denies this.
The trial has begun in southern Spain of 95 people accused of corruption in the development of property in the luxury resort of Marbella. Local officials are alleged to have accepted millions of dollars in bribes from developers. Here's Sean Fanning of our Europe desk.
Prosecutors speak of a vast corruption network involving bribes to local officials to get approval for property developments. Two former mayors of the upmarket resort on the Costa del Sol are among those accused, along with lawyers and building contractors. The charges include corruption, money laundering, and misuse of public funds. In the event of convictions, possible prison sentences range from 10 to 30 years.
BBC News. The International Monetary Fund has given its strong backing to the British government's plan for a big squeeze on public spending to cut the country's record budget deficit rapidly. The IMF praises the plans of the Conservative-led coalition government, saying they will greatly reduce the risk of a costly loss of confidence in the country's public finances. The opposition Labour Party says the government risks damaging public services and causing another recession by cutting too quickly. Two leading reformist parties in Iran have been banned. A spokesman for the judiciary said the Islamic Iran Participation Front and the Islamic Revolution Mujahideen Organization had been dissolved by a court ruling. Both parties strongly backed the opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi in last year's presidential election. The German technology giant Siemens says it knows of 15 industrial plants around the world that have been affected by a computer worm, which attacks software sold by the company. Iran says the worm, known as Stuxnet, has attacked some computers at its Bushehr nuclear facility, but that the plant's main computer system hasn't been affected. Stephen Evans explains how the worm works.
The technique of the worm is to insinuate itself on thousands of computers. It then searches for a very specific piece of computer code made by Siemens and known as WinCC. This program's used to regulate big industrial plants like breweries, water treatment or chemical plants, all similar in configuration to a nuclear plant. If the worm finds exactly the right piece of software, it then comes alive and spreads to paralyze the system unless it's detected quickly by counter software.
The manager of Pakistan's international cricket team, Yawar Saeed, has resigned. His move follows the team's troubled tour of England, which was overshadowed by allegations of corruption against several Pakistani cricketers. No formal charges have been brought. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley. Welcome to Europe Today. First, Britain's Labour Party, which governed the UK for 13 years until this spring, has elected its youngest post-war leader. Ed Miliband, who's 40, beat his brother David, among others, over the weekend and has promised to overhaul the pro-Washington, pro-business agenda set in place by Tony Blair. Critics who say he'll steer the party too far to the left are already calling him Red Ed. He says he's offering a new start and a new chance for the opposition after Labour was thrown out of power in May and a centre-right coalition took over under David Cameron. In a moment, we'll be asking what Ed Miliband's chances are of becoming the next British Prime Minister. The leadership tussle between the siblings has been taking place during Labour's annual conference in Manchester in the north of England. David Miliband, addressing the conference for the first time since his defeat, started by paying tribute to his supporters and to his brother.
I want to, first of all, say that I've been incredibly honoured and humbled by the support that you've given me. But we have a great new leader, and we all have to get behind him. I'm really, really, really proud. I'm so proud of my campaign. I'm so proud of my party. But above all, I'm incredibly proud of my brother.
He's been offered a job as the opposition's finance leader by his brother, but he won't say yet whether he'll accept it. David Miliband did say he'd prefer people not to stop rather confusing the two of them.
The guy who came up to me after the Usdaw reception and said, Ed, congratulations on your victory. I mean, I can do without that. I can do without that again. So if he's in the hall, that's just about enough, I think, for that.
Well, when Ed Miliband took to the stage in Manchester on Saturday, he said that a new generation had taken charge of the Labour Party, a generation that understood the call to change, and he promised voters that he got it about why Labour had been defeated in the general election. So if he is to get the party back into power, what does he need to do? The BBC's Sarah Montague spoke to drinkers at a pub in Manchester and asked them how they'd voted in the last election.
We didn't this time because we didn't know who to vote for. Who
do you normally vote for?
Labour.
And why didn't you vote for them this time?
Because I didn't trust them. I didn't trust any of them, actually, so I just didn't go.
Did you vote at the last election?
No.
Why not?
Because they're all the same. They're all a big letdown. I'm working class and everyone's a letdown as far as I'm concerned.
Who have you voted for in the past?
Labour, usually. They're giving handouts to everybody and working people are getting let down by Labour.
You work?
Yeah.
And you feel that life's...
Yeah, I'm being let down.
Well, let's talk to the political editor of the New Statesman magazine, which has traditionally been supportive of the Labour Party, although not above criticising it. Mehdi Hassan joins me. Mr Hassan, are you a fan of Ed Miliband?
I wouldn't say fan, but I would say that we supported his candidacy for the Labour leadership. We backed him after a long discussion in our offices over which Miliband brother would be best for Labour. And we came down on the side of Ed, thinking that he would be the best candidate with the best vision. And we were delighted to see him win on Saturday.
And what direction do you hope he'll take Labour in then?
I hope he sticks to the vision that he articulated during his leadership campaign, which is that the new Labour period is over, the era of triangulation is over, the era of being overly close to big business and the banks and the disastrous route that led Labour down is over, and of being over deferential to, for example, the White House in foreign and defence affairs is over. I also think it's important to reach out and win back 5 million Labour voters who deserted the party between 1997 and 2010.
Will he be Prime Minister?
Well, will he be Prime Minister? We all have our crystal balls. I think he has a very good chance of being Prime Minister. This coalition is a new part of British politics. We don't have one party in rule. We have the Tories and the Liberal Democrats in coalition. They're not as popular as perhaps previous governments at this stage in the election cycle have been. They're only 6 months into office and already Labour have them at level pegging in a lot of the polls. Without a leader, Labour were doing quite well. And we've still got a lot of very painful cuts to public spending to come in the next few months, which would suggest that this coalition's only going to get more unpopular.
I mentioned the name Red Ed that's been coined already by critics of Ed Miliband. Anything that's perceived as left-wing tends to get a very hostile reception from a lot of the popular press in Britain.
Of course it does.
Will he weather that?
Well, will he weather that is a very good question. It's how he defines himself and doesn't allow others to define him. Is it a surprise that the press reacted this way? Of course not. A lot of these papers had their headlines ready to go. Red Ed, I think, was on the front page of about 9 out of 10 right-wing papers on Sunday when I looked around. They're all ready to go, and that's because a lot of the press in this country is owned by foreign-based, multi-millionaire, tax-avoiding press barons. So it's not a surprise that they don't like the idea of someone who wants to crack down on tax avoidance or introduce a high pay commission. That doesn't mean that those policies aren't popular with the public. Two of the most popular things Gordon Brown did before he left office was to introduce a 50p tax on those earning more than £150,000 and a bonus tax on the bankers. So if Ed Miliband, I can assure you, if Ed Miliband carries on down that road, he will have a lot of supporters amongst the public at large, both right-wing and left-wing, neither of whom are happy with, for example, the financiers.
Thank you very much. That's Mehdi Hassan, political editor of the New Statesman magazine. The programme after us, World Have Your Say, is live from the Labour Party conference in Manchester. Ros Atkins presents it and joins me. Ros?
Hi, Paul. Well, it's been interesting to witness all of the Labour Party members discussing what's going on. Of course, they've been following the drama of the two Miliband brothers, but something else has been going on over the past few months, and that's if you look at the Labour politician who's received the most plaudits, you could argue it hasn't been any of the candidates. In fact, it's been their acting leader, Harriet Harman, MP. Some of the members wanted her to go for the leadership. She decided not to. She's now reverting to her previous job as deputy leader, and she's going to be live on World Have Your Say for an hour talking about women and politics. She wants to ask our audience all around the world why it is that women remain in the minority in the vast, vast majority of countries. Carol's emailed us from America saying it's because women are still judged by their looks. John has said don't do quotas in Germany, which is where he's from. It won't work. I want MPs who are capable, not just in the job because they're women. And lots of our African listeners are saying in Africa politics is aggressive, it's backstabby, and they say women aren't like that. I think they mean it as a compliment, but they say politics in Africa isn't suited to women. So we've got guests from all over the world to talk about why it is that in most countries women are still in the minority in the political class. If you'd like to speak to Harriet Harman, go to worldhaveyoursay.com and send us your phone number.
Thank you, Ros. World Have Your Say up after this programme at 17 hours GMT. You're listening to The World Service. This is Europe Today, and still to come, we'll be live in Germany, where some people are worried they'll be forced to bail out more struggling Eurozone countries.
It's not so nice, but I think also many Germans would agree that it's better to do this and save the euro than let the euro fall down.
That's coming up now. They had to build an extension of the courtroom in the Spanish city of Malaga to accommodate the 95 people accused. Today, one of Spain's biggest ever corruption trials opened. It revolves around alleged dodgy real estate deals in the upmarket resort of Marbella. Two former mayors are implicated, as are former town hall officials, lawyers, business people and flamenco singers. One of the accused, a builder, Rafael Gomez, told reporters as he went into the court this morning that he'd done nothing wrong.
I'm a victim, you understand? And my family even more so. Because when you do something, you have to pay for it. And I'm an honest, legal man who never breaks the rules.
Well, the trial is expected to last a year. Howard Brereton is a journalist in Malaga, editor of the news website typicallyspanish.com. Howard joins me. This is essentially about people being paid backhanders for permission to build on land that was supposed to be off limits, right?
Exactly, yes. It was permission for land that was classified not suitable for building, be it rustic or be it too close to the coast in that upmarket resort that is Marbella. 95 accused and huge amounts of money allegedly moving hands here. The man at the centre of it, Juan Antonio Roca, was in the town planning department of Marbella Town Hall. And, well, he's facing charges of collecting more than 33 million euro from backhanders from various builders and others. He's denying it all, of course.
When is it all alleged to have happened? Because this is a case that many people will have in the depths of their memory. It goes a long way back.
It goes a long way back. The instruction judge here, who opened the can of worms, if you like, Miguel Ángel Torres, did that about 5 years ago. The man at the centre of it, Juan Antonio Roca, worked for the late mayor, Jesus Hilly Hill, and he was mayor in the town from 1991 to 2002. He died in 2004, but things really seem to have gone off the rails when he handed over to Julián Muñoz, who became the mayor after him and was from his Hill party.
Most of the buildings that were built are likely to stay empty. Some were built on floodplains or on national parks. There's a legacy to this alleged corruption.
Yeah, well, some of the buildings are actually occupied, and some are occupied by residents of other European countries as well and worried about it. The current mayor of Marbella from the Partido Popular, Ángeles Muñoz, she says that she won't knock buildings down, so they're trying to find a way that somehow the town hall can be compensated, perhaps by the builders, for those builders being there. But you're right, in some other rural cases there have been buildings built on floodplains, and these will be knocked down, I feel.
And it's seen as a test case for the national government, briefly.
Well, the national government has been criticised wider afield outside Marbella. The person at the centre of this rocker, he comes actually from Cartagena in Murcia. He has real estate interests there. The Valencia region's very much in the news with the land grab law. Lots of residents from other European countries implicated there. So this is gathering a lot of international interest to see how exactly the Spanish judiciary will handle this. The judge has been trying to keep it moving, as it were. But what happens in Spain is there's first preliminary questions. These are going on for about a month, we're told. These are the questions like, and it's happened today already, one lawyer said, look, this phone tapping evidence should be thrown out. Another lawyer said that people were treated irregularly by the instruction judge, so on and so forth, looking for ways to either delay the case or to get it shelved. So all these preliminary questions coming first.
Thank you very much, Howard Brereton in Malaga. Now, Licia Ronzulli is an Italian mother. She's also a member of the European Parliament. Most women might want to keep those two defining roles in their life separate, but not Licia Ronzulli. With us to explain all is our reporter Manuela Zaragoza. Manuela.
Well, you might have seen this photo of Licia Ronzulli, Paul, in the past few days because it's been published in newspapers around the world. She's an MEP. She went to vote on legislation at the European Parliament and she was snapped sitting in Parliament with her daughter, Victoria, who's 1 month old, strapped to her chest in a sling. And that photo was reproduced in papers around the world, putting the whole issue of working mums in the spotlight. So I asked Licia Ronzulli whether she'd been making a political statement when she brought her daughter to work.
It wasn't really a political gesture. It was a choice because of several factors, mainly maternal reasons, but it was also a logistical issue, a necessity. Not because I don't have a babysitter, that would be unthinkable, but I have a very strong attachment to my daughter. I breastfeed Victoria, and I do that 6 times a day. And what's more, as a newborn, Victoria was in a specialist neonatal unit where they taught us this fantastic method, which consists of keeping in constant physical contact with your baby to pacify her so that she listens to your breath and heartbeat 1 hour before mealtime. And this vote in the Parliament when she was with me was exactly in that hour before she was due to feed.
Were you surprised by the kind of media attention that was generated by photos of you with your baby in the European Parliament?
I would never have imagined that the photo of me and Victoria would make its way around the world. I got messages of support from women the world over. No one criticised my decision to come into work with her. Many colleagues came to shake my hand, even those who are at the opposite end of the spectrum to me politically.
What would you have done if your baby, Victoria, had started crying during the parliamentary hearing?
Had Victoria started becoming restless, I would have got up and left the parliament and missed the vote, as any mother would have done at the end of the day.
I have to ask this. Where is your daughter now? Is she with you?
Yes, she's with me.
But she wasn't strapped to her. She was in a buggy, that I know. That's Licia Ronzulli, MEP for Italy.
It's amazing, really, that it's still controversial. That how much have things moved on? Right, this is Europe Today. You don't even have to understand Swiss German to find this funny. And trade in dried meat isn't normally the stuff of high comedy. But Switzerland's finance minister, Hans-Rudolf Merz, has become a big internet hit for his parliamentary speech on import and export tariffs applicable on Bündnerfleisch. Hundreds of thousands of people have watched the 67-year-old politician on YouTube as he collapses in giggles, trying to be serious about the complexities of the issue.
Der Charakter einer Ware dieses Kapitels nicht verändert wird. Klammer zum Beispiel. Zum Beispiel Bündnerfleisch.
It's quite infectious, isn't it? His colleagues in Parliament seem to find it enjoyable. They even applaud him at one point. His giggles last about 2 minutes, and eventually he regains his composure. He's found fame. People living in a remote mountain region of Georgia say their land is being seized by the government to build a multi-million dollar ski resort. The region, Sfaneti, has for centuries remained more or less untouched because it's so remote. Some of those who live there claim the government's ignoring traditional property rights. They think that it's all about Georgia's president, Mikhail Saakashvili, securing his legacy as a moderniser in the last 2 years before he stands down from power. Tom Esselmont reports.
In the summer months in Sfaneti, the rivers flow fast, and under relenting blue skies, cows nibble the tops of yellow flowers in high mountain pastures.
But the traditional sounds in this stunning part of Georgia are now being drowned out by the whir of bulldozers. This region is being turned into a ski resort. President Saakashvili himself has personally ensured that $50 million of government money will connect Sfaneti with the rest of Georgia by a new concrete road, which they're building here. The 11-hour drive to get here will be a thing of the past.
People like Murtaz can remember the days when Sfaneti, and more importantly its main town of Mestia, was completely cut off from the rest of Georgia. He's pleased with the development. He's been hired as a worker, his face reddened by the year-round sun. He says this is good for business.
For 6 months of every year, we are unable to get to Sfaneti. The snows and heavy rains, when it was cut off. We're building the road, and when it's finished, it's going to impact very positively on our salaries and our lives.
But not everybody's happy. Further down the valley, this field has now been bought, we're told, by a Canadian investor who wants to build a hotel as part of the new resort. But Leila Japaridze says it belongs to her mother.
My mother was one of the only ones who was fighting against the local authorities. She was one of the only ones who spoke out against this project. Now she's been arrested. She's a political prisoner. After her arrest, there's very little opposition in Mestia.
Did your mother do anything wrong, do you think?
No, as far as this project is concerned, she's done nothing wrong.
Leila says the local authorities have ignored age-old traditional property rights, the unwritten codes by which people were attributed plots of land centuries ago. Under pressure to get the job done quickly, the local authorities shut their ears to people's complaints.
So, Sfaneti, this is Mestia, part of Sfaneti, which is northwest of Georgia.
Keti Gujaridze runs an NGO called Green Alternative. She is a die-hard opponent of the ski resort, not just for environmental reasons. She says no one is listening to her concerns.
If they are sufficiently consulted beforehand, I mean, before starting the project, I believe many Mestians or many Sfanetians would support the project. But the basic problem is that they are not consulted at all.
In August this year, national television showed the telegenic president Mikhail Saakashvili skiing down a glacier in Sfaneti. To his critics, it was a sign of just how much he intends to define his own legacy with expensive projects like this.
When you see pictures of President Saakashvili skiing down the glacier of one of the most prominent mountains in that region, what do you think?
What I think is that this person doesn't think of all the things. Well, if you looked at other projects he supported this way, I mean, showing up in this this way, this is something related to this legacy also. Mm. Yeah. Oh.
Everyone here adores Svaneti's traditional music, its sturdy stone buildings and its pine-brushed hillsides, and the authorities say their big plans won't harm any of it. They deny that private land is being grabbed without permission. The local governor is Gotcha Chilidze.
Many of the traditions were lost here during the Soviet times when Russian planners came here to build. By restoring this town, we will also restore original quality visually and spiritually.
The government appears intent on modernizing this northwestern corner of Georgia. But it's hard to believe that there won't be more opposition in such a rustic area, especially in a place which over the centuries has been so resistant to change.
Tom Esselmont reporting from Svaneti in Georgia. Aaron Armstrong joins me now with the latest sports news. And Aaron, focusing on two big events facing a race against time to be ready.
Yeah, the Commonwealth Games we know all about. We'll come to that shortly. But first, the head of Formula One, Bernie Eccleston, has expressed doubts over whether the South Korea Grand Prix will go ahead as scheduled on October the 24th after an inspection at the new circuit. It's in a place called Yeongam, the southeast of the country. It was cancelled. Work's yet to be completed. Red Bull have tested the track, so that seems to be okay. But more peripheral things like accommodation for the teams perhaps aren't ready. However, the BBC's commentator Martin Brundle says Eccleston wouldn't say such things if he didn't have good reason.
Bernie's sending a very strong message to somebody there. He doesn't say things like that lightly, so clearly there is a concern. And, you know, they're breaking their own ground rules in terms of preparation of circuits. They have to have an international race. They have to be signed off within a certain amount of time. And, of course, it'll have a massive impact on the championship as well. If there are only three races remaining instead of four, I don't know if they'll try and add another race in or have two races at one of the remaining venues. If we don't have that race, it'll be a great embarrassment for Korea and for Formula One.
So worry for Formula One, but there's even less time, Aaron, for the Commonwealth Games, snakes in rooms and all that. What's the latest from the athletes' village?
Well, yes, with that in mind, some are still opting to stay in hotels at the moment, understandably. The England team are moving in today and tomorrow. Their apartments have been described by their chef de Michon as acceptable, three-star rather than five. And it seems that the teams who've complained the hardest or the loudest have got results. Perhaps some of the African teams who haven't said much, well, still work to be done on their accommodation. Some athletes continue to pull out of the games, though. Two Australians did so yesterday. But the Isle of Man's team manager, Trevor Taub, and this is interesting, he lost several of his track cyclists, but he feels some athletes have overreacted.
I would say they've probably been hasty in their choice based on the information that the media has presented, certainly back in the UK. And I would question the media going to the degree they've gone in doubting that India could pull these games off. They have got our accommodation good, and I'm pleased to say when we moved in this morning, I can't fault the accommodation we've got, and the facilities around the whole village area, absolutely first class.
The games, of course, beginning on Sunday.
Thank you, Aaron. That's Aaron Armstrong with The Sport. You're tuned to the BBC World Service, broadcasting now.
If you're new to the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to Listen.